From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. NPR correspondent David Folkenflik has reported on some of the nation's most important media-related stories. They include the elimination of federal funding for public media. Folkenflik will be in Spokane next week for an SPR event at the Bing Crosby Theater. Today, we get a sneak preview of what he might address. Eliza Billingham takes us into the field with Spokane police officers to hear what they think about responding to service calls with mental health professionals. And we talk with Bob Inglis, who served South Carolina for 12 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's a Republican who is urging people in his party to support free market remedies to address climate change. Inglis was in Spokane this week. Join us for this hour of Inland Journal. David Folkenflik has quite an interesting job. He's NPR's media correspondent, and there's plenty for him to write about, from the way President Trump interacts with and uses media, to changing ownership of media organizations, to the elimination of federal funding for public media. Folkenflik will be at the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane next Tuesday night for an SPR-sponsored event. He'll answer your questions. Recently, we met on Zoom to start the conversation. How do you determine what stories that you like to do?
Sometimes it's as much about turning away stories as accepting them. I try to tell stories that tell us something larger about the moment we live in, or tell us something, you know, kind of transporting about the people involved. You know, and I hope to talk about this a little bit when I come and visit. But at the heart of what I do, I think, is to talk about the calling and the profession and the craft of journalism and how it's done well, how it falls short, the ways in which there are incredible financial and political pressures on journalism. But really the idea being in my head that I want to make sure, as I think NPR does try, to make sure that people have enough information to make decisions and choices for themselves to act as citizens and not just as consumers, right? But around that are a whole lot of other things. There are the businesses that own these media outlets. There are the people in it. There are the business pressures buffeting them. There are, as I mentioned, the political pressures and regulations. There are the challenges of doing reporting, covering wars, as we have been doing for so many years now. You know, what a challenge it is to figure out how to get news to people in news deserts where news organizations may be collapsing or just not able to sustain. But also then the media companies around them are often involved in other things like entertainment, like pop culture. The world of politics affects media greatly. Social media, digital enterprise, it's all kind of in this stew. I used to think of the media as this side dish that was served alongside, and they would come up and say, oh, Dave, it's really cute what you do, and you can sit beside us at the big people's table, and you know, we'll let you do it. Right now, media is at the heart of what we do. It's the heart of how our current president operates. It's the heart of how business tries to get out what it does through what it calls stories and narratives. You know, these are all things that have been mediated through the media, whether the press and the news media or popular culture or through song or film or whatever. So all these things end up becoming part of my beat in a lot of different ways. And so I pick and choose. You know, we have exactly one media reporter at the moment. You know, the New York Times might have 8 or 9, but I think we are able to capture for people texture of what happens, the consequences, why things matter. You know, what are the stakes? At the moment, they're just huge stakes for all kinds of stuff.
When the CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting story came that the federal government wanted to defund the corporation, did you decide that that was one that you wanted to cover, is one that you felt obligated to cover? And then covering your own organization, what's that like?
Well, covering your own organization is, you know, something I would recommend to people who really enjoy root canal, you know, are delighted to be in traffic for 2 to 4 hours a day. You know, like, this is not something I would wish upon people. And at the same time, it's the right thing to do. You know, we have built a compact that we're going to tell the news without fear or favor about all these other major media organizations. So we think it's important that we do that about ourselves as well. Many years ago, I'm trying to think exactly how far ago it was, you know, call it 2008, we had some layoffs. And there was a point at which a very senior editor came into the room that I had borrowed. You know, I had a cubicle, but I had borrowed somebody's private office to write about this because, of course, it's about our colleagues. And he said, hey, you've got to tell me who told you that so-and-so was laid off, who was a host of a show a guy I respected enormously named Alex Chadwick. And I said, well, let me ask you, are you asking as his editor or are you asking as my boss and the editor of my story? And this senior editor paused and said, I'm not sure. I think as Alex's editor. And I said, well, tell me why. And he said, you know, Alex is out. He's trying to take care of his wife who's sick and get her some treatment. And I want to make sure he hears from us first. And I said, that is a totally legitimate thing to want. And you should share that information with me. And I'll take that with people who then edit my story separately. But you should get the heck out of this office because you can't wear both hats at the same time. And starting at that point, I devised with the help of some other senior editors who understood what I was trying to do, that we would kind of put ourselves in the corner as though we were in a little space capsule off the mothership floating in space so that we could report and edit our stories absent any involvement or even visibility from senior news leadership, much less our corporate executives. And we've kept to that ever since. And so it means I think that we have a more dedicated approach to covering it. I meet with editors involved in this, we call the protocol, once a week by Zoom to talk it through. And, you know, it's been a very intensive time, but we think that if anything, listeners of Spokane Public Radio and NPR more broadly are oversubscribed in their interest to this issue in a way that maybe somebody else might not choose to click on that story. This is like, hey, this is going to affect the news that you hear, the programming you hear, the availability and options that you have, and it may change the evolution of the public radio or public media infrastructure. So we should be the ones to tell that story, preferably, you know, with as much independence as possible.
We're talking with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. So, David, we were talking earlier about being a media correspondent. What does a media correspondent do? Who do you pay attention to?
So part of what I do is I go on social media and Twitter and certain other social media platforms as well and see what stories are playing out around the world, around the country, in Washington. Obviously, Washington, you know, sucks up so much of the oxygen. And I do a lot of stories involving the cliche these days is the intersection. It's really the collision of media and politics and power. And that's what's happening. And that's what's shaping who owns so much of commercial media these days, whether it's on the national level and, you know, the Ellison family taking over in just less than a year, all of Paramount, CBS, but poised to do so for Warner Brothers Discovery, which includes HBO and CNN and so much more, or on the local TV scene, where you've seen Nexstar already, the nation's largest owner of local TV stations, in just a real quick swoop, taking over so many stations from Tegna, which used to be Gannett. And that'll affect what happens in so many markets around the country as well. I try to figure out ways to tell stories about, you know, what's happening abroad and covering war, what's happening in Washington and the push and pull of power, who's holding the president to account, how is the media falling short of its own mission. But also I try to dip in and say, look, these are stories that have ramifications on local levels. And sometimes things are just playing out at the local level. One of the things I love about NPR, it's given me an opportunity to explore so many different nooks and corners of the country, not only in my native or my home state of California, but throughout the country. And so, you know, I've done stories from Alabama. I've done stories in the Northeast. I've done stories out West. I'm delighted to be coming to Eastern Washington and to Idaho to explore there as well. But, you know, life as it's lived is not lived in Washington, right? Life as it's lived is not exclusively in New York City. Those are equally valid parts of the American experience. But so much of what happens is explained to people and reflected to people about their communities through their local news outlets. And so I try to tell those stories as well, and particularly in the voices of people who tell the stories and people who experience them and the people who absorb them. So it's an on-the-ground thing, not done sort of remotely from an ivory tower. Mm.
So one of the things we're talking about here is the need to continue to do more local news and grow our local news. And I think a lot of the local stations are trying to do that. So do you think that NPR's relationship with local stations has changed any through all of this in an attempt to try to elevate local news and integrate it better with NPR?
Well, I think you've seen that in recent years. I think if you look at, for example, the Texas newsroom, NPR has been involved, not the only party involved at all. The newsrooms themselves have done this, but really in a collaborative level to figure out how they can coordinate and collaborate and not just do five different versions of the same story affecting Texans, but look at ways they can plus up what they offer by enhancing coverage, planning things through from the outset about what they're covering. Some stories may not be relevant for all stations, and that's fine. There are ways in which we're kind of been a convener for that and allowed them to work out their own locally based genius on that. I think that there's definitely been, in some quarters, a resentment of NPR, that the criticism of NPR from the Trump administration, its allies on Capitol Hill, has felt that, you know, among some stations or among some listeners, hey, it's the national network that's been a source of frustration. But there are a lot of stations that are actually proud of the association, the affiliation, I would say most are, that I talk to. And they see the textured richness of the reporting offered by NPR. But NPR also is enhanced greatly by having, you know, hundreds of stations that provide local news, much of it which percolates upwards into our news reporting, into our understanding. When big news breaks, we're often collaborating in real time to make sure our reports are right from people who understand the places on the ground. So I think you're seeing, even as there are other models being developed and being offered and evolving, I think you're seeing NPR seeking to work more collaboratively at this point journalistically. That's at least what I've observed from the inside. Although, as is always the case, I don't speak for NPR corporately because I'm the poor guy who has to cover it.
David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent. He'll be on stage at the Bing Crosby Theater next Tuesday night, April 14th, to answer your questions. You can get tickets through SPR at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Crisis response used to mean putting out fires or chasing down criminals. But in Spokane and across the country, first responders are getting more and more 911 calls for behavioral health crises, sometimes drug-induced, sometimes not. To address the shift, Spokane is now deploying 8 co-response teams, pairing mental health experts with officers from the fire department, the police department, and the sheriff's office. SPR's Eliza Billingham explores how these teams work, how they define success, and how they fit into a system peppered with gaps.
Officer Josh Zuri is responding to his first call one Thursday morning. He's an officer with Spokane Police Department's Behavioral Health Unit, or BHU. A Frontier behavioral health clinician is with him, too. They've gotten a call from someone in an apartment in North Spokane who says their neighbor has been screaming all night. Per HIPAA rules, I'm not recording any of this. But once the co-responder team is at the apartment complex, the screaming is confirmed by another neighbor. It's a woman, they say, and they point to her truck in the parking lot. Zuri runs the license plate and gets a name. The clinician runs that name through Frontier's records. Yep, she's in the system, she says. Zuri runs the name through police records. He sees an arrest that he was a part of. Yeah, I remember this woman, he says. With the records side by side, the co-responders get a clearer picture of the woman who's been screaming. She's been arrested and gone through treatment multiple times. She's likely fallen off her management plan.
The biggest thing the call response gives the community and the benefit of that is it gives the responding teams a holistic look at the individual they're dealing with.
That's Captain Curtis Reese with the Spokane Police Department.
Frontier can't see what the police history is, and this person may have been contacted 50 times in the last 3 days, and we can't see the mental health side of it or their charts or anything that's going on. So when you have the two different entities coming together and looking at kind of the holistic person, you can kind of see, oh, this isn't a police issue. This is definitely a crisis issue with mental health, or maybe this isn't a mental health issue. Maybe we have some criminal stuff we have to deal with, or whatever that may be.
Zuri goes up to the woman's apartment and knocks. Nothing. He tries again. He talks to property management. He spends at least an hour trying to get a hold of someone who isn't actually doing anything criminal. Austin Skinner is a deputy with the Behavioral Health Unit in the Spokane County Sheriff's Office.
Having teams that are designated to handling these situations definitely relieves the pressure from patrol having to go to them. A lot of crisis calls end up being pretty time-consuming calls.
Zuri goes back to the woman's door one more time. After a few more attempts, he hears something. She's mimicking his knocking on an inside wall. She's banging back, he says. That's contact right there. Then, suddenly, she's at the front door, screaming at him without opening it. She tells him to leave and then runs further into the apartment and slams an inside door. That's it. Zuri doesn't have the authority to force his way in. So he and the clinician head back to the car to fill out paperwork. They tell property management to call 988 if she starts screaming again. If the team could get her to talk to a designated crisis responder, they might be able to ITA her. ITA stands for Involuntary Treatment Act. That state law says if someone meets a high threshold of danger to themselves or others or presents a grave disability, their civil liberties can be taken away and they can be forced into treatment. The thing is, there's a lot of time between being ITA'd and being put in a secured facility because there are almost no secure beds in Eastern Washington. Eastern State Hospital is the only psychiatric hospital on this side of the state that can take ITAs. And after recent policy changes, it doesn't take very many. So even if the team could get this woman into a local hospital and a designated crisis responder ITA'd her, the woman can decide she doesn't want to go to Eastern, walk out of the local hospital that can't legally detain her, and go back home. Such are many days in the life of the behavioral health unit. Or she could decide that she wants to get back on her treatment regimen and go through a voluntary treatment program, like the one run by Pioneer at the county's Crisis and Stabilization Center. Rayanne Padgett is a program administrator at Frontier Behavioral Health. She says the road to recovery is long.
I think working in crisis field, success can be varied depending on the day. And so a lot of it is whether or not it was a good contact and we planted a seed in that individual's brain to call sooner or to call 988, get a support, reach out for help.
Anne Raven is an administrative battalion chief for the Spokane Fire Department. Fire has similar co-responder teams that partner paramedics with mental health clinicians.
We're trying to get them the actual help they need for long-term success. And that is success, even though, unfortunately, it doesn't necessarily equate to them going to treatment right in that moment. These are long-term interactions, even though they're happening on an emergent basis. We do see the same people over and over again. Our teams do interact with these people over again, and they end up usually getting connected to some kind of service.
Mental health issues and drug use are almost always intertwined, the experts tell me. Fentanyl use is decreasing in Spokane, but meth is back on the rise, officers say, and with it, the chicken and the egg question of whether schizophrenia or meth comes first. In lieu of enough involuntary treatment beds, some people start thinking of jail as the only alternative secure detox facility. Officer Casey Jones has worked the downtown Spokane precinct for over a decade. On a different Thursday morning, Jones is driving his typical route along the outskirts of downtown. When he cruises by the 7-Eleven gas station on 2nd and Division, he recognizes someone. Well, Jones recognizes most of the people he passes, but he recognizes this guy because Jones is pretty sure he has a few warrants out. He checks his records. He's right. The most recent one is for harassment at the library. By now, this guy has seen Jones and takes off on his bike. Jones swings around the corner to cut the biker off as he crosses the street. There's no struggle. This guy is mainly disappointed that he's going to lose all his stuff. As Jones searches, he finds an eyeglass case with two glass pipes and two meth crystals in it. Each rock is about the size of an acorn. Illegal possession, that's a new charge, Jones says. Jones drives over to the jail, which already has a handful of cars in the booking line. As he waits, Jones talks to the man he just arrested.
Do you want to get clean off meth? So this is the thing that I see. People try to keep their feet in both worlds. I understand you want housing, but how you don't think your meth addiction has any influence on your being on the streets? And it does.
Their conversation about addiction lasts nearly the hour it takes to get the man booked.
You're going to jail today. You have to take care of your warrants. This is a can you keep kicking down the road. You got to take care of that first. Jeremy, this is not a hindrance to you getting clean. In fact, this is probably the best way to do it. Listen, over there, you could walk right out the door. In fact, that's why I quit taking people there in lieu of jail, diverting people, because I would get a call 5 minutes later. Yeah, you just ran out the back door.
By over there, Jones means the county's voluntary stabilization center. All the officers I talked to agreed that adding entry points to services and warm handoffs between resources is a good idea, but they often feel like a lot of people just don't want help.
I want you to start seeing value in you getting clean. I wish I could make people want it, but I can't.
Officers feel like they're a small part of a huge system that isn't delivering.
You know, I see the ins and outs, how the system's broken, but I have no control over that. What I do have control over is that I do my best. I kind of joke with jailers sometimes because I go in there so often. I bring so many people in there that, you know, it makes them work and they kind of razz me, but I let them know taxpayers deserve my best. So I just do my best in this big machine. If Jeremy has a change of heart eventually, it's worth it.
I'm Eliza Billingham reporting.
Bob Inglis admits he's a bit of a Republican dinosaur.
I'm a conservative. I believe in the Constitution and the rule of law. I believe in balancing budgets. I believe that America has a role in the world and that it's important to use diplomacy first. It's important to work through international organizations. I think all of those things are conservative. So I'm a little bit out of step with the tune playing on Republican radio at the moment, but I believe that really the current tune is going to be in oldies here pretty soon.
Inglis represented South Carolina for 12 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. In 2010, Republican voters told him they didn't want him anymore. Now he's the executive director of Republic EN, a group that promotes free market solutions to climate change.
Well, we think it's really all about fixing the economics. And so the hard thing that we got to say is, let's tax it. And that may sound like, what? That's not conservative. Well, actually, if you go back to, for example, seeing Milton Friedman on the Phil Donahue show in the 1980s, Phil asking, what do you do about pollution? Then Dr. Friedman, if you don't want to regulate it. Friedman says, you tax it. You tax pollution. This is the father of the Chicago School of Economics, Reagan's economics advisor. And then he goes on to explain how you got to make products bear their cost, all of their cost, to the marketplace. So the consumers and the liberty of enlightened self-interest can choose their self-interest. And so what we think it starts with is just a carbon tax that's paired with a reduction in payroll taxes. So there's no growth of government. And it deals with the problem of regressivity. You know, if you just have a naked carbon tax, it really hurts poor people. But if you reduce their payroll taxes while you're doing the carbon tax, Congressional Budget Office says the bottom 70% end up better off with that tax swap. And then, of course, the key, Doug, is you got to apply that tax to imports. And that's where the action is you're going to have this, it's called a carbon border adjustment mechanism. And so if we apply the tax to imports coming from a country that doesn't have the same carbon tax, it makes it in their interest to follow our lead and to apply a carbon tax internal to their own country, because otherwise they're forking over money to the United States government when their goods land in our ports that they could have collected themselves. And so it makes it in their interest to do the same thing. And then 8 billion people start seeing what Milton Friedman talked about. They start seeing in products the true cost, because now they're built in. So you go to the grocery store after this happens, carbon tax happens, and you got the paper plates and you got the plastic plates. Well, the paper's up a little bit, chainsaw gas, natural gas at the paper mill, drying the paper, that has to be included in the price of the product. But the plastic plates, wow, they're up in price. It's all petroleum, all natural gas, all the time. And then consumers, bigger paycheck in their pocket, get to choose. Now, some of them will choose the plastic. And we're for freedom at republican.org. If you just like plastic plates, go ahead and buy them. But if you're cheap like me, and I think most people are, they're going to pick up those paper plates. And that's going to happen on every shelf in the store. There's going to be some greener, cleaner, renewable thing that's now relatively cheaper than the dirty stuff that's just been made accountable. That'll make the innovation happen because we will have seen the price. It'll be built into the price of the products.
State of Washington has a Climate Commitment Act whereby, one, our gas taxes are higher, but two, that we also have carbon credit auctions and companies will pay that. Well, certainly Washington pays among the highest gasoline taxes in the nation. Mm-hmm. Would that continue under what you're talking about?
I would think that Washington State would want to revise that once we got a federal system here. Hats off to Washington State for leading on this. It is a challenge because what Washington State can't do is what I've just talked about here, is can't do that carbon border adjustment mechanism. Only the federal government can do that under the U.S. Constitution because it is essentially a tariff. It would not set off a tariff war like we're in the midst of right now. It is a different thing. It is, in fact, a tariff, a carbon tariff. But it's consistent with existing World Trade Organization rules that you can apply a tax based on the content of the stuff coming into your country. And this would be a carbon content tax. We think it'd be upheld by the World Trade Organization and consistent with existing precedents.
So where's the obstacle here? Is it a political obstacle whereby some people are going to have to admit that climate change is actually a real situation, or does it go deeper than that?
I think it's a problem of trust, really. We can put on a carbon tax, but I'm going to cut your taxes somewhere else. Trust me? And unfortunately, right now, it's most people would say, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I trust you. And then there's also the challenge that we're dealing with folks that are succeeding at a game at the 10-yard line when most of the game needs to be played within the 40s, you know, in politics. It needs to be somewhere between the 40-yard lines that you're making policy. But we have people on social media and in that world that become very influential by playing really somewhere between the 10-yard line and the goal line. You know, I mean, they're out there, both right and left. I mean, saying really nutty stuff. But it works for them because they get clicks, they get followers, and they can monetize that. And it's, I don't know, tell me how we fix that. I don't have an answer for that just yet.
So if you look back at your time as a congressional member, would you, I mean, now you've been away from it for 15 years, do you think differently than you did back then? Would you have taken this position 15 years ago when you were in your last, you know, when you were running for re-election for Congress?
Well, that was a problem I did. So, yeah, and in a way, you know, I'm the worst commercial for this. It's like, Inglis, look what happened to you, man. I mean, you got cut off from the tribe. But I would say that was in the darkest days of the Great Recession. That was 2010. I mean, you know, the fall of 08, the wheels were coming off the financial system. I was at Gonzaga yesterday. I asked the students, how old were you in 2008? You know, and they're holding up one finger or two fingers or three fingers. And I said, okay, so your parents will remember, though, that banks were failing. It was a really difficult time. And so came the 10 cycle, and we were still in the Great Recession. And that's when I lost in a Republican primary. You know, after 12 years in Congress, got just 29% of the vote. The other guy got the other 71% of the vote. And the most enduring heresy coming out of that was just saying that climate change is real. Let's do something about it. And I had proposed exactly what I'm talking about here, the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. It's a revenue-neutral, border-adjustable carbon tax. And so that revenue neutral means, of course, we were going to cut payroll taxes, we're going to put on the carbon tax, and then we were going to apply it to imports. So that's the border adjustable aspect. And so that and some other heresies got me in a lot of trouble. And so I was tossed out. And at that point, you know, a foundation came to me and said, you know, you're an unusual zoo animal, an actual conservative, you know, who says climate change is real. Will you speak and write for the proposition? So that's what I've been doing ever since. And so I'm actually encouraged by what I'm hearing here lately. I think we are moving on to the next. People are beginning to realize that the braggadociousness, the hoaxerism stuff, it's getting a little bit old. And so they're starting to look around for the next. I felt that last night, for example, at the Young Republican Club of Spokane County. They were open to hearing the message.
Bob Inglis is the executive director of the climate policy group RepublicEN.org. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SPR News. We're on the radio Thursdays at 12:30 and Saturdays at 2:30, and on the web for listening anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. So is our morning podcast, SPR News Today, hosted by Owen Henderson. It's posted every weekday by 7:30. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.